This is Tim Benal. I want to welcome you to a very special bonus edition of Benal of America Audio, Benal of America Audio Special Session. When the Scooter Libby indictment broke, I knew we had to get the word from someone who knew what was going on and who could provide a heads up on what was coming down the line, and I knew that had to be Webster Griffin Tarbley. The man is a geopolitical researcher and terrorism expert of the highest caliber, best known for his George Bush, The Unauthorized Biography, a masterpiece of research which is still a must-read. A decades-long expert on international terrorism, he directed the study Who Killed Aldo Moro, commissioned by a member of the Italian government, and published in Rome in 1978. It broke open the affiliation of the Red Brigade with the neo-fascist Lodge P2. He's also the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA. This is a top-notch book. It covers the 9/11 story from top to bottom and in-depth. Webster and I sat down on October 29th, a scant 3 days ago, to discuss the Scooter Libby indictments and what all this meant for the Bush administration and for the world at large. This is a very special bonus edition of Benal of America Audio under the banner of Benal of America Audio Special Session. Ladies and gentlemen, Webster Tarpley on Benal of America Audio. All right, ladies and gentlemen, I want to welcome Webster Tarpley to Benal of America Audio, and this is going to be particularly timely because the indictment against Scooter Libby came out yesterday, and for those of you who don't know Webster Tarpley, he's the author of 9/11 Synthetic Terror, Made in the USA. It's probably the best 9/11 book I've read. It covers everything in depth. It's just a tour de force is the best way I can put it. It was awesome to use the parlance of the times. This is a fantastic book. You got to go out and read it if you want to understand really what was going on 9/11 and the roots behind it and where it's going in the future. And that's pretty much where we're going to pick up is where it's going in the future. Webster, welcome.
Well, I think we've thank you very much. Thank you for your kind words. We can do the crisis of the Bush administration, but what are the strategic implications of that? Because I think most people don't see it. Then we're going to have to go back to Watergate, and then we'll come back into the present to do this unprecedented concentration of military drills next week, starting on the 1st of November, which means now. What we've got to do on an urgent basis is learn the main lesson of 9/11, which is, you can sum it up in one word, and that's MIHOP. The government, the rogue network, the secret team, the invisible government, parallel government, secret government, call it what you will, the people you got to know during Iran-Contra, the Secords, Oliver North's, Felix Rodriguez, Craig Fuller, their gang, who brought you the gun running and drug running of Iran-Contra, the moment when this whole thing broke into the public view, they have not gone away. And the main thing you have to know about 9/11 is that it was a terrorist provocation run through the U.S. military and security bureaucracy, and this was done under the cover of terror drills and war drills. And we have a 9/11 truth movement, and the problem with it is that some people in this movement have been going backwards. A lot of people started from the official version, right? The official version, which was put out in the speeches of Bush, put out in the news media, put out in various books, finally codified into the Kane-Hamilton Commission. That's bad enough. That's absolutely bankrupt, and we can go into why in a sort of a peripheral way. Then you have some people are stuck with the official version with unanswered questions. I'm afraid some of these people, when Gabriel blows his horn and the dead rise from their sepulchers, they're going to come up out of the ground with unanswered questions. It's too late for them. We've got to answer some of these questions urgently. Then we have LIHOP, Let It Happen on Purpose. This is the the Ruppert thesis, I guess, most notably. I think this was an acceptable halfway house, but now it's increasingly bankrupt because it increasingly fails to capture the essence of what's going on. LIHOP, Let It Happen on Purpose, presupposes that there really is an Al-Qaeda, there really is bin Laden, there really were 19 hijackers, and what the Bush regime did was to kind of pull back defenses and allow it to happen, facilitate it. In this Delmar Vreeland quote that Ruppert likes to quote so much, let one happen, stop the rest. This is fundamentally wrong. This is not how it was done. We're now up to about 13-plus drills, war games, exercises on 9/11. And the really interesting ones are not the ones that Ruppert talks about. Ruppert likes to talk about the ones that tended to suppress air defense by removing planes to northern Alaska and Canada and places like this. That's all fine, and that's an important component, no doubt about it. But the ones that you've got to focus on, and maybe we get back to this when we talk about this in some detail, are things like the National Reconnaissance Office Chantilly, Virginia drill, which involved what? Crashing planes into buildings. And I think there's a strong prima facie case that that's where the steering of planes into buildings was accomplished, from the headquarters of the NRO out here in Northern Virginia at Chantilly, which is also an agency that can see the whole thing in real time from satellites. And the other one I would mention is Amalgam Virgo, which involved an exercise hadn't involved in recent years before 2001, the launching of a cruise missile from a freighter, a rogue freighter supposedly, in the Gulf of Mexico. And I take it that that's the drill for whatever hit the Pentagon, which was, of course, not a commercial airliner, but some kind of a unmanned aerial vehicle or unidentified flying object or cruise missile or whatever you want to call it. We've also got a couple of others that I'll talk to you about in a minute. I think that the really big one on 9/11 is the one we call Global Guardian, which is an all-out Armageddon thermonuclear war exercise. So if you put all these together, and if I can pull up on my computer the right page of my slideshows here, I can probably tell you some of these. We have 13-plus exercises on 9/11. I think Ruppert had 4 or 5. In my book, published in the springtime, we were up to 6 or 7. But now with recent research, above all with a book called Code Names by William M. Arkin. I guess since I'm plugging somebody else's book, I better plug my own. Mine is called 911 Synthetic Terror, Made in USA. Please buy that through Amazon. If you buy 911 Synthetic Terror, you can buy it on Amazon. You can get a copy also of my Bush biography, Unauthorized, 1992, the full story, the original story on how Prescott Bush supported Adolf Hitler's rise to power. We can't talk about this now, fascinating though it is. You can get both of those sent to your home for less than $30, and you help me because it is a way to increase the Amazon rankings and help me to get into bookshops, which is where you can actually sell more books than I'm able to sell right now on the internet. Just to try to keep track of this, I'm trying to look here in my slideshow, and if you just bear with me, I think I'm going to find it. The different ones, Amalgam Virgo, Vigilant Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, Northern Vigilance, Northern Guardian, Tripod 2, those we knew, but then on top of that comes Global Guardian plus, Crown Vigilance, Apollo Guardian. Anyway, there's a whole long list.
These were all going on 9/11?
Yeah, 13-plus on 9/11. And again, Ruppert was up to 4 or 5. He focuses exclusively on the ones that have to do with the air defense. And again, that's certainly important, but that's only a small part of the story. Here we go. Let's see. Day of the drills. Let me see if I can get you to this. Okay. Amalgam Virgo is the general exercise that prepares the whole thing in advance. That's done some months in advance. Okay. That's the shooting the cruise missile off the freighter. Vigilant Guardian, Northern Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, Northern Vigilance. Those are pretty much the air defense suppression drills. In addition to that, we have Amalgam Warrior. Then we have Global Guardian. That's the really big one. That's Armageddon. Crown Vigilance, Apollo Guardian, National Reconnaissance Office drill. We have AWACS and an unnamed drill over Florida and Washington, D.C. And we have the Fort Myer, Virginia firemen doing a drill, and they're the ones that have to go directly to the Pentagon. And in the New York City area, we have Tripod 2 and Timely Alert out in New Jersey. So you get up to 13-plus drills. Now, let's try to connect this to the present situation, because the lesson that we should have learned by now is that if there's going to be state-sponsored false flag synthetic terrorism, it's run through the military security bureaucracy of the country in question. In other words, it's done through the Pentagon, through the CIA, through the NSA. Not all of them. And it's conducted under these code words and disguises precisely because it's conduited through an atmosphere where at least many people would not support it. Some might be against it. Some might denounce it. Some might try to shut it down. But the people who are on the inside of this stuff know pretty much what it is they're doing. Now, as we speak here, this is the Saturday evening after the fall of Libby, and we're sitting in a trough, perhaps, between the indictment of Libby and the possible further indictment of Rove. But we also have to realize that there's an initial complex of scandals, which certainly have the capability to bring down the Bush administration. But on the other hand, we can't kid ourselves about what some of these things mean. Obviously, the Valerie Plame story, the CIA leak, has been the big one. But behind that is something even bigger. Before you could send anybody to Niger, there had to be a story that yellowcake uranium had been procured from Niger. And along the way, one of the things that buttressed that story were a series of forged documents. They're very crude forgeries coming from Rome, coming from the Italian military intelligence, SISMI, S-I-S-M-I, and the head of that being Niccolò Pollari, probably he's one of these suspect members of the P2 Lodge in Rome. And these are crude forgeries that indicate Saddam is trying to buy uranium yellowcake from Niger, which produces it. Again, the crude forgeries, worthless. They were brought to the U.S. Embassy in Via Veneto by an Italian woman journalist by the name of Burda, B-U-R-D-A. And they're forgeries. So they were, however, sent to Libby, to Cheney. They were eagerly passed around. They were used to convince Bush and many others that indeed there was this threat, which then became the basis for Colin Powell's speech at the UN, which was written by Libby with the help of these documents, and they also became the famous part about Iraq looking for nuclear weapons in the 2003 war speech that Bush gave as a State of the Union. The forgers involved here, according to many accounts, there's a secret Italian parliament report on the forgeries, which has been sent to Fitzpatrick, sent to McNulty, who's the prosecutor doing the Israeli mole case in the Pentagon, and presumably others. Presumably the whole U.S. government has this now. How did these forgeries come about? The word from Rome seems to be implicated are Michael Ledeen, a top neocon. It's interesting the configuration you have within the neocons. Most neocons go back to Leo Strauss, who was a protege of Carl Schmitt, Carl Schmitt being Hitler's lawyer, Hitler's main legal advisor, Carl Schmitt and his Jewish sidekick, Leo Strauss. That's the mainstream neocons. Ledeen is of a slightly different parish. He comes from the Mussolini side of fascism, the D'Annunzio Mussolini side. He calls it universal fascism. And it's known that the main terrorism advisor to Karl Rove is Ledeen. So Ledeen is implicated in these forgeries, along with Dewey Claridge. Sounds like an Iran-Contra reunion, if you can remember back that far. Dewey Claridge was indicted in Iran-Contra, pardoned in December 1992 by Bush Sr. And, of course, we have the famous story of Ledeen with Larry Franklin, who has pled guilty as the Mossad mole in the Pentagon, or a Mossad mole in the Pentagon. So we've got, as I'm just saying, Ledeen, Larry Franklin, Harold Rode, all from the Office of Special Plans, meaning Fife, Luti, Schulsky, neocons, going to Rome in December 2001 and making contact with Manoushehr Ghorbanifar, their old friend from Iran-Contra, and beginning to set up what became the Iraq War. So you've got, just to keep track, the Plame case, the Niger yellowcake, Then on top of that, you've got Ahmed Chalabi, who's in the middle of all of these things, giving U.S. state secrets to Iran. Well, who gave Chalabi those secrets in the first place? That's another one. And then the one we've been mentioning, which is the Mossad mole configuration in the Pentagon, which focuses for the moment on Larry Franklin, but which could then become much broader, could include Rode, could include Feith, could include many of them.
So let me just jump in here. So,
yeah, please do.
So what you've got is a lot of scandals brewing here, and maybe this Libby thing was like the first domino in a series of
We certainly have to hope so, because the other thing is now that Libby is being squeezed, you have to realize there's a fault line here. The real doctrinaire neocon is a follower of Leo Strauss. For example, Libby is a disciple of Wolfowitz. Wolfowitz was a disciple of Alan Bloom. Alan Bloom was a disciple of Leo Strauss, who was a disciple of Schmidt, who was Hitler's lawyer. It's that kind of a lineage.
Yes.
But Cheney, Rumsfeld, Rove, they don't have this. So from the point of view of the neocons, the indictment of Libby is a disaster because he's one of their guys. They have to defend him. But Karl Rove is just a redneck scoundrel. He's a merchant of smear and sleaze from the Texas boondocks. And
so those guys aren't part of this clique.
They may be part of the clique, but when the pressure comes on, the difference is between a real doctrinaire Leo Strauss, neocon, fascist madman who's ideological, and somebody like Rove, they would regard him as pragmatist, who's simply it's interesting. You know, Rove goes back to Watergate. If you remember Watergate, remember this political saboteur and dirty trickster called Donald Segretti? Well, Rove was exactly the same kind of person and may indeed have worked with Segretti. He was a college Republican doing dirty tricks for Nixon and Bush back in the mid-70s. So he's just he's a political thug. The notion that Rove has any particular power, I think, is a joke. Libby is 10 times more important than Rove. Libby is one of the people, he's probably one of the 3 or 4 people who did most to create the Iraq War.
Oh,
Rove
really?
Has no such power, yeah, of course.
Oh, okay, because the mainstream really makes it seem like Libby's second foot.
No. Look, Libby tells Cheney what to do. Cheney tells Bush what to do. Then you have to see who tells Libby what to do. It's not that he's the secret dictator. Probably George Shultz tells Libby what to do based on a consensus of financiers that he talks to. It's an oligarchy, so make no mistake about that. But in terms of Rove, Rove operates simply in the area of public opinion, perception mongering, vote fraud, election coups, things like this. It's important, but it's simply the puppet side. In other words, Bush is a puppet, but he's a puppet who's got to get reelected, and for that they have Rove.
So he's sort of Bush's sleazy puppet master.
Yeah, but the question here is, Rove does not make policy. Rove simply tries to hang on to power.
Yeah.
And the more, in other words, you've got to remember, the modern American presidency is a puppet office.
Mm-hmm.
Bush is a puppet. Cheney is a slightly more important puppet, but he's a puppet nevertheless. When you get to somebody like Libby, you're getting at least closer to the lines of communication that lead back to oligarchies and to the location of real power, which is emphatically not in the White House, because it's an oligarchy, right? And Bush is expendable, Cheney's expendable. Now that Fitzgerald is squeezing Libby, his only way out is to say, Cheney told me to do it, indict him. And that would be coherent with neocon doctrine. They're not going to go out and bleed for somebody who's not really one of them in a way that Cheney simply is not. Now, we've gone through the complex of scandals that's most immediately ticking away, right? The Valerie Plame, the Nigel Yellowcake, the Ahmed Chalabi, and the Mossad mole in the Pentagon. Then, of course, there's another group of scandals, which is the stolen election of 2004. It's got this character, No. You know this guy, Dr. No in Ohio, the coin dealer? Stealing tens of millions of dollars from the Ohio Workmen's Compensation. What you're getting into there is the actual mechanics of the Ohio vote fraud machine. And then, of course, you'd have to go back to the corruption of the Supreme Court in the year 2000. But then, of course, the overarching scandal of the Bush administration is September 11th.
Yes.
Terrorism. It's the attack on this country. It's the complete cover-up. It's the nuclear danger that Bush was courting on 9/11 that we could probably get to later, especially if you remind me. Now, here's the thing that I think we have to be aware of. The Bush regime right now is a wounded beast.
Mm-hmm.
They are cratering. They're in very, very bad political trouble. But this solves nothing. And I've got to invite you to go back to the Nixon White House during Watergate. Now, Nixon was an unstable personality. He was a drunk. He was a scoundrel. He was a liar. He was all these things. But compared to Bush, Nixon was a realist who was less subjected to psychopathology than Bush is. Bush is obvious. You can look at Bush and you say, there's a person who has gotten through the day because he's drugged to the gills, and they're, you know, they're giving him medicaments and psychopharmaca and whatever else they have to keep him off the bottle, to keep him going. You know, he's got to sleep for 8 or 10 hours. He's got to run for 3 or 4 hours or ride the dirt bike. He can focus on something for 15 or 20 minutes a day. They're lucky. This is a wounded beast. Now, let's go back to Watergate. I want to talk about three things.
Okay.
The preface being, if you watch carefully while Fitzgerald was giving his speech yesterday, the 28th of October, you'll see that some of the networks had three screens. They had one of Cheney giving a speech, one of Bush giving a speech. You didn't get to hear what Bush or Cheney were saying, but you got to hear what Fitzgerald was saying,
yeah,
which I guess is more important. What Bush was saying was he was making war threats against Iran and Syria.
Really?
This has to be taken absolutely seriously. Yes, he said the basic content of that speech that Bush was making that you didn't get to hear, he was trying to look presidential, but he was also making war threats saying Iran and Syria are outlaw states and our patience with them is running out. So these are war threats. And you've been in an area of war threats for those countries for a year or more. You've had acts of war taking place. You have illegal overflights. You have illegal teams going in on the ground. You've had firefights with Syria, two or three of them in the last 6 or 8 months. So the stage is set for a war. Now, back in October 1973, the Kippur War, right, the Middle East War that had been set up by Kissinger and a long story was connected with the oil hoax of that time, the fake oil crisis that I have to think of every time I hear people prating about peak oil. We get to that maybe if we have time. But the heart of the matter is that in the middle of October of 1973, Nixon, in the midst of that Middle East war, ordered an all-out U.S. nuclear alert, one of the few times in the Cold War that this was done. And that meant that the B-52s took off, the submarines went into position, the missiles were on immediate alert, and all the rest of it. And the Soviets, of course, saw this, and the Soviets went to their own worldwide red alert. So the world was on the brink of nuclear war.
Oh, wow.
That was October 1973. Now, in retrospect, actually pretty soon, but it became known a little bit later, the Prime Minister of Great Britain, Edward Heath, as a conservative Prime Minister of Great Britain, said that nuclear alert was absolutely uncalled for and reflected the desire of Nixon to get attention away from his troubles on the home front by having a thermonuclear alert. Now, this ought to prove that when you get a desperate, demagogic scoundrel of the Bush or Nixon type, they think nothing of taking the world to the brink of nuclear war if they can get some kind of short-term political advantage. Now, let's talk about two more examples of the same thing.
Okay.
If you see documents that came out of the Nixon archives last summer, I think in May was the ones that I remember, they talk about the Nixon White House during Watergate. The head of the National Security Council is Kissinger, who's also the Secretary of State, and then you've also got General Alexander Haig, who's the Chief of Staff. And sometimes Nixon would ask for the football, meaning the nuclear launch codes that are carried in this case, usually by a military officer who's got to tail him wherever he goes. Nixon asked for the football, and you can see from these documents that Kissinger and Haig had an arrangement whereby if Nixon asked for the nuclear launch codes, the two of them, Haig and Kissinger, would go into a special vigilance mode to see what was he going to do. Nixon was drinking. In these same documents, you get, for example, Edward Heath, the British Prime Minister that I just mentioned, would call and they'd say, oh, he can't talk to you. He's indisposed. And he was soused to the gills. He was too drunk to come to the phone. But in the middle of some of those fits, he would ask for the football. So they were watching to see that he didn't you know, in a fit of depression, launched World War III.
Yeah.
Then finally, the most acute form of it came in the last weeks of the Watergate collapse of the Nixon White House. The defense secretary by that time was James Rodney Schlesinger. You sometimes still see him around. He's a kind of a neocon avant la lettre. So he was sitting in the Pentagon. He put out an official order to all U.S. military commands saying, if you get a directive from Nixon telling you to undertake military action, you are ordered to ignore it, to disregard it, unless and until that order for military action is approved either by me, Schlesinger, or by Kissinger, or by both.
Huh.
So Nixon had essentially ceased to be president. Now, that is what we need at this point. We need a mechanism. We need a group of senators. We need somebody to come forward with the courage to say, Bush is now a danger for starting the Third World War. He's obviously mentally unstable, right? We have the whole Dr. Justin Frank study, Bush on the couch. We have these outbursts that he's been having, right? We've had all kinds of articles in Capitol Hill Blue, even quoting Bush's personal physician that they've got him drugged up. We've got all these stories about the dry drunk, that he maintains the mentality of an unreformed alcoholic. This guy is on the brink. And so what if he starts drinking again? Just something as simple as that.
Oh, Jesus.
What if some neocon fascist madman, again, you got to remember, the neocons in some ways are the real loose cannon right now, because the neocons, you know, somebody like Wolfowitz, Richard Pearl, these are little princelings, right? They're little Lord Fauntleroys. They don't want to go in the penitentiary. That's
certainly not.
Exactly what they don't want. They're too delicate for that kind of stuff. They like other people's kids to go to war and die, but not them. They don't want to go. So suppose a neocon fascist madman decides things have gone far enough and it's time to, you know, stop mucking around in the Middle East and, you know, let's have an H-bomb on Tehran. Why not? So he goes into the Bush Oval Office or up at Camp David where he is now and says, let's solve this problem with a flight forward into some kind of thermonuclear insanity. What's the ability of Bush to say no? And the other thing is you look at this cast of characters that I've just mentioned, right? Haig, Kissinger, Schlesinger, people of this sort. Scowcroft was there too. You'd have to say those people are all criminals and warmongers in their own right. But if you compare them to Rumsfeld and Cheney and Card and Condi in particular seems to be, you know, so weak that she's practically non-existent. Is there anybody around Bush right now who would have the courage to say no or to put out that Schlesinger order saying disregard all orders from Bush and Cheney, because you've got Cheney also that would be a danger for this kind of stuff? So I think we're in a very grave situation, and this is where people have got to say, do you have some senators? Are there some congressmen? Is there somebody willing to stand up in the Congress? You notice that because the U.S. intelligence is so discredited because of the lies of Colin Powell and the lies of Tenet at the CIA and all the rest of them, in the case of Syria, they farmed out the report. They got a German prosecutor from Berlin to do the investigation on the Hariri assassination and try to implicate Syria, right, so that they can have a war with Syria, because if the U.S. said so, nobody would believe it. But now they have this German prosecutor. The only thing I can say is if that guy's a prosecutor in Berlin, it means that about 15 years ago he was working for one of the Western powers, the British, the U.S., or the French, because that's what Berlin was if he was in Berlin at the time. So something would have to be said about, you know, where this character is coming from.
So do you think we'll see something here in the States, or are they just going to go right into Iran, maybe set up something
Let's try to turn to this.
Okay.
On 9/11, there are basically, as we've just said, these complexes of drills, and the ones that we were mentioning, Northern Vigilance, Northern Guardian, Vigilant Warrior, and things like this, these were indeed designed to strip the air defenses by taking these fighter planes far away from New York and Washington. And they were also involved putting in fake blips on radar screens in the guise of hijacked aircraft, and also to have real tangible, you know, flying airplanes, commercial and military, who were pretending to be hijacked, so much so that we got up to 20, 21, 22 different hijack cases at the height of the morning of 9/11. Then we've got, however, the other ones that interest me more at this point, because I think they're the ones that point unmistakably to the MIHOP side of things, although these other drills also do in their own way. The National Reconnaissance Office Chantilly, a drill on that morning, crashing a plane into their building. Now you have to ask, what is the purpose of that? You have to imagine two officers sitting at a console. One officer is a traitor, he's a criminal, he's part of the rogue network, he's not loyal to the Constitution, he's loyal to this private group that ultimately reports to Wall Street and indeed to London. The officer sitting next to him is loyal. So the loyal officer looks over at the criminal officer's console and he says, wow, crashing planes into buildings, what is that? And the criminal officer at that point can say, that's the NRO exercise for September 11th. And by the way, you don't have a security clearance. You can't look at it, and I'm not going to tell you anymore. So in this way, they can bootleg it through. They can conduit the operation through your own military security operations. And this is also done because, remember, in most military drills, one side is playing offense, one side is playing defense, and deception operations are built into the drill. So you're opening up little doors. The more realistic you make the drill, the closer it comes to being real. The classic use of these things, as I point out in my book, 9/11 Synthetic Terror, is the, Slobovia and Fredonia. So Slobovia is holding summer maneuvers. So they say, we're going to have three divisions of our glorious army for summer maneuvers along the border with Fredonia. Don't be worried, it's just our routine, regular summer maneuvers. And then once the divisions are along the border with Fredonia, the thing goes real, they cross the border, war has begun, and the surprise attack on Fredonia has taken place under the cover of these drills.
Exactly, yeah.
There's an example of this from the Cold War, which I think is worth recording, because it gets us into where I think we are today. Abel Archer 83. Abel Archer 83 was a worldwide nuclear drill under Reagan, and it was a time of great, great tension. It was right after the Korean airliner had been shot down in September of 83, or around that time. And the Soviets looked at Abel Archer 83, and they said, this is announced as a drill, but to us it looks like it's going to be the real thing. So the Soviets at that point went to Red Alert on their own.
Wow.
And we were once again at the brink of thermonuclear war, and then there was a gradual back down from that. My experience in this stuff, just to mention one other, was Hylex 75, Hylex, High Level Exercise 75. In 1975, the German news magazine Spiegel published an account of Hylex, which included this notion, which was more or less the following. Since the U.S. had been driven out of Vietnam, and since this humiliating fall of Saigon, Schlesinger and some others that we've mentioned were looking for a way to stabilize the U.S.-British strategic position in the Cold War, and they were considering whether a thermonuclear confrontation might be just the thing. So they said, let's start it as Hylex 75. We'll start it as a drill, and if necessary, we can take it into the area of, they weren't really thinking thermonuclear war, I don't think, but they were thinking of some kind of a confrontation along the lines of the Cuban Missile Crisis or the Berlin Crisis of 1961, the Checkpoint Charlie, and the rest of that stuff. So there was a case, and the reason I tell this story is because this 30 years ago, I spent Christmas Eve 1975 on the steps of the Milan Cathedral in Milan, Italy, with five or six of my friends, handing out leaflets, telling people, call your congressman, call your government, call your trade union, whatever it is, call your political party and protest the fact that NATO is preparing a possible thermonuclear confrontation. And indeed, this seems to have had some effect in taking it down. I won't be able to say how much until we've actually opened the archives. Now, the other one on 9/11 that we have to mention is this Global Guardian. If you look at my book on 9/11, I've got a mushroom cloud on the front. I don't have falling buildings. I have a mushroom cloud. And the reason I did this was because I was convinced that the thermonuclear aspect of 9/11 that didn't happen, at least did not happen in full,
yeah,
it happened up to a point, was much more important than the things you saw, much more important than these buildings crashing down, Pentagon, Shanksville, whatever it was, because you were dealing with thermonuclear questions. The heart of the matter was Global Guardian, and it has now been discovered since my book was published, essentially in the early months of 2005, it has become clear that there was an Armageddon nuclear warfare, warfighting drill on the morning of 9/11, and it was Global Guardian. And this essentially is to mobilize everything, submarines, land-based, B-52s, B-1s, everything there is with nuclear bombs, and have that all ready to go. If you look at the description, I can send you to cooperativeresearch.org. You can look up Global Guardian, or just look up Global Guardian on one of these search engines.
Yeah.
You'll see that one of the features of Global Guardian was information warfare. And within that information warfare, they say that in order to add to the realistic nature of the drill, they had a rogue insider or bad insider as part of the drill who had the ability to launch nuclear missiles using a key command and control system. Now think what that means. It means that in the middle of a nuclear drill, they're faking a rogue element who wants to launch. How easy it is for that rogue element to become real and to launch. In other words, you've opened a little door through which Armageddon can indeed enter into the room. And the reason for this would be the following. Remember, the main event of 9/11 that most people have completely forgotten about is the phone call between Bush and Putin.